Sorry about that. The person who does computer simulations can't get the computer to work. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Aaron Meyer. I have been working on the interface between Lattice QCD and neutrino physics for a while now. And so I'm going to talk about some recent results from Lattice QCD in the hopes of trying to help out the neutrino community. So I'll start out by introducing the problem. Hopefully it is motivation for itself. But I will talk about some of the problems that we see and why we should be using the Lattice to try to help neutrino physics. And then I'll go through some case studies trying to say exactly what problems we're trying to solve on the Lattice, what the main difficulties of those problems are, and then what computations have been done recently to try to solve those problems. And so I'll start out with the more technical things, the ones which have been done more recently and with much more vigor than the previous than some of the other ones, including some algorithmic studies to try to better solve these problems more efficiently, and also just some brute force attempts to try to bang away and really figure out what all the systematic uncertainties are. And then at the end, there are some other things which are very much works in progress and not so well developed, but they are interesting. And so at that point, I will be more saying, here they are, and you can do what you will with them. And then I'll wrap up. So OK, let me start with the introduction. So Lattice QCD has been very successful over the past decade. There are lots of computations from lots of collaborations, and they measure a wide variety of observables. So for instance, this is the mass spectrum of many mesons and many baryons. And so what you have to do is you have to fix the parameters of your QCD simulation. So you have the lattice spacing, you have the quark masses for the bare quarks that are included in the C. And then you also have the QCD theta term, which is usually set to zero. So you can otherwise ignore that. And when you do run the simulation, everything is in dimensionless quantities. So you have to fix the scale somehow. And you do that by setting these scales with observables. So you pick something which is well known from experiment, like the pi n decay constant. And then you fix the scale with that. And then once you've done that, everything else is a prediction of the QCD simulation. So what you see here is a whole bunch of simulations all done with different lattice actions. So there's many ways to do the computations. All done with many different observables, many different numbers of ensembles. So the more ensembles you have, the better you can control your systematics. And this is what's represented here. So some of these symbols are open. These mean that these were used to fix the scale, as I was describing. And the ones which are filled symbols, which are here, are predictions of these simulations. And so you can see they do very well in trying to reproduce the spectrum of the entire, all of the baryons, all of the mesons, including some of these heavy mesons up here, which have been subtracted to bring them onto the scale. Did you have?
So, Aaron, yesterday you told us that baryons are numerically much harder.
Yes.
I don't see that so reflected in the plots.
There are more statistics for those as well.
Yeah, so why don't you take the same statistics? You just say.
You can also do the simulations at larger pion masses and extrapolate down to the continuum.
Right, so you play those things.
Yes.
So in a way, maybe the meson areas are more trustworthy.
Sorry, say that again?
The ones where the meson are the more trustworthy.
Yes, usually they are.
Why does the input seem to differ for the kaon, for example? The orange seems to be higher than the other one?
So for the kaon, that's a good question. I don't know that.
What was the question? It's not very important. Some the orange dot in the kaon.
Yes.
That's a little bit higher.
So this one was used to fix the scale. And so they fixed the scale to a slightly higher value than the other collaborations. And I don't know why that is. Could just be a different number was used.
Or is it maybe a plotting artifact?
I don't think so.
Okay, maybe we can do charge.
I will refer you to the reference for this. But OK, so the point here is that QCD predicts a wide variety of observables. And you can go through the whole process of trying to figure out what these observables are. And there's consistency between lattice QCD and experiment, and also self-consistency of lattice QCD measurements done with one computation type to another computation type. So it's a very robust way of computing things, computing observables, including all of the radiative corrections of all the gluons. So another thing which it's used for is to determine the decay constants, the meson decay constants, which are then used to extract the CKM matrix elements. And this allows for very precise matrix elements, where you have the errors highlighted in blue here are the errors coming from the decay constants. And so you can see that these are actually more precise than the experiment results. So it's a very robust way of doing this, and it helps you to get down to very precise results. So one wonders, if you can do such precise things with the lattice, then can you do that for neutrino physics as well? And of course, the answer is going to be yes. So we just want to figure out how to make that work. Now, this is something which has been harped upon by everyone today. There's many different aspects to a neutrino physics measurement, involving the experimental data and also nucleon form factors, nuclear models, and putting those into Monte Carlo and trying to make a prediction for your experiment and to try to constrain your oscillation parameters. And ideally, you'd like to have a lot of interplay between all of these things for constraining them and then using them to constrain other things and have lots of validation checks. But sometimes that's not always the case. For instance, you may have a piece which is missing. For example, the nucleon form factor, the axial form factor, is difficult to measure experimentally because you either have a large nuclear target because you need to have more statistics, or you have a small nuclear target which is better theoretically but has super low statistics. So there's no real way around that from the experimental side. So because you have this, you're constraining the form factor from a nuclear model and then using that form factor to constrain your nuclear model. So there's a redundancy here, and you end up with some sort of circular argument for what's determining your nucleon form factor. And you'd like to break that. So the way to do that is to introduce lattice QCD and use lattice QCD to fill in this gap where your experiment's missing. And that way, you can constrain your nuclear models without relying on the nuclear models to do that constraining and to try to break these degeneracies which show up in your determinations of the form factors. So this is where lattice QCD can really help neutrino physics, is to fill in the gaps where other extrapolations may be missing. So here's one example of a very clean, theoretically radiative process. This is the quasi-elastic scattering, as has been seen before. This is just a neutrino turning into a muon by interacting with a free nucleon. And so there's a whole bunch of hadronic junk which is going on in here, and we don't know how to calculate that analytically, so we approximate it with a form factor, and the form factor is just based on Lorentz symmetry. And this factors into a matrix element which looks something like up at the top here. Now, this breaks into two parts. One is one that you do on pencil and paper. It's very simple to do. You can probably do it in the audience here while listening to me, or maybe not listening to me. And the other side is the messy hadronic part. So this is where you fill in with lattice QCD. And so you just use a hadronic current insertion there, and you simulate that, and then you plug that into your form factor parameterization, and then use that to inform yourself of the entire process. So that's what we're going for. Now, how do you do a lattice simulation? Well, you need to reduce from an infinite number of degrees of freedom to a finite number, and this is to solve the path integral formula, so this thing up here. Now, in order to make things finite, you need to take your numbers of degrees of freedom and reduce them. And the way to do that is by discretizing space-time. So you have some finite lattice spacing, which is ultraviolet cutoff. And then you have your lattice box extent, which is your infrared cutoff. And these are the limits of where your theory is being evaluated. And then you have to try to evaluate the fields on those. So you define your quark fields on the sites themselves, and then you define the gauge lengths in between the sites. So on the links between them, this is just to satisfy gauge invariance, which if you didn't have that, you'd have lots of problems. You do this in a Wick rotated time, so you have Euclidean time. Everything goes as exponential decays up to boundary condition effects, which we're not going to worry about. So this means that we have lots of systematics. So you can imagine varying any one of these parameters, and you have to try to figure out what the effects of having these parameters not be at their physical values, and how that affects your results. So if you want to have full control over all the systematics, you need to simulate lots of times. So you need to have multiple lattice spacings and then extrapolate down to the continuum limit where you have your lattice spacing go to zero. You can have multiple pion masses, or you have to simulate a physical pion mass. Typically, that's not done because of variance problems, or because it's computationally more difficult to simulate at lower pion masses. It just takes longer. So you have to do some sort of extrapolation down to the chiral limit where all the masses are at their physical values. Then you have multiple volumes. You have to try to extract the infinite volume limit by essentially taking multiple volumes. You should have more quarks in your virtual sea. The typical nomenclature is 2 plus 1 or 2 plus 1 plus 1. This refers to up and down quarks, which are in the isospin limit, so they have the same mass, and then you would have a strange quark on top of that, and then if you have an extra one, you have the charm. There are some simulations which are doing 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 now to try to take into account these isospin breaking effects. And then typically you need some renormalization technique. This is different for different lattice actions. Some of them break chiral symmetry explicitly, and you have to correct for that. Others have chiral symmetry, but you still have to take into account the normal renormalization, which you would think of in the continuum theory. When we are doing neutrino physics, we need to calculate nucleon observables. And you could ask, well, they've had a long time to do these, so why haven't they done them yet? And the reason is that baryon matrix elements are very difficult to do. So the simplest argument is that the signal to noise grows exponentially, or decays away exponentially. And this is just a simple argument. You have some sort of operator which gives you a nucleon, so it's a three quark operator. And when you're computing the noise of that, you have to take the absolute square, which then gives you a three pion operator, which tells you that your noise is growing faster than your signal, or in some sense, your signal's decaying away. It's a very simple argument, just variance argument. So the second thing is you have finite size effects. So you're fitting everything inside a box and then trying to extract the infinite volume limit from that. And so if you have a big baryon inside a small box, then it's going to self-interact by emitting a pion. The pion goes through the periodic boundary conditions and comes back and interacts with itself. So nothing is ever free within your lattice box, and you have to try to account for that by doing some sort of systematic check. The other thing is excited state contamination. Because you break rotational symmetry, now you're not explicitly projecting down to the ground state. So you end up with a tower of excited states, and you have to try to fit all of these away. And so it turns out that it's a sum of exponential decays. And I read once in some sort of computational physics book that if somebody comes and asks you how to fit a series of exponential decays, you're supposed to violently kick them out of your office and tell them to never come back. So this is exactly what we have to do, and there's no way around it. So it's just a complication that we have to deal with. Now, lattice QCD is very useful when you have a well-defined matrix element. So I mean well-defined by saying that you can write it on the blackboard, as Gil did yesterday with a four-point current. It means that you need to be able to, I'm trying to distinguish between something where you are trying to pick some intermediate state, where you this cannot be explicitly picked on the lattice. So you have to try to evaluate things which are well-defined in that sense. You also want it to be difficult or impractical to measure an experiment. So I could compute the vector form factors on the lattice, and that's a nice consistency check, but probably the experimental data is going to be more precise than the lattice. So you could just use the experimental data in in place of that. And then it also gives sizable contributions to systematic errors. So one thing which experiment does not constrain well is the pseudoscalar form factor, but it's not very important for neutrino physics, at least at leading order. It's something which can be computed, but it's not the first thing you want to focus on. Now, one thing about lattice QCD computations is that they have large overhead costs. And once you pay those costs, you get lots of other computations for free. So I usually say it's buy one, get 10 free, or buy one, get 100 free. And a lot of times, what's limiting is the manpower to actually go through and analyze all of these things. So sometimes you'll see computations which show up out of the blue. And that's because of this overhead cost argument. So when you're doing a lattice computation, what you're doing is you're actually putting an operator onto the lattice, and then you're taking it off at some later time. And so this is just giving you some matrix element, which is an overlap factor. We typically call it, for a vanilla type calculation, we typically call it a source and a sink. And then you're just pulling these things apart in time. And this, according to Hamiltonian time evolution, gives you some exponential decay function. And then we're summing over a whole bunch of these contributions. So this is your typical two-point function calculation. And this is what you do to measure the spectrum. Yeah?
I mean, your statistical argument was very attractive. But where do I see the three pions here in this case?
So the three pions are, you're going to have essentially your three pions created here, and then they propagate to this point, and then they're annihilated here.
Would that always be accompanied by the nuclear mass?
Yes, they will. So your signal is going to go over the same distance as well. So your signal is decaying, and your
would it in this case not be e to the minus nuclear mass plus three pions?
Yes, that's the idea.
So if t really goes to infinity, that's how you eventually win.
It's the other way around. You eventually lose out as you go to t equals infinity.
What I'm not seeing is how you can get a single 3-pion term.
A single?
How you create 3 pions out of this current?
It's the square of the current that you're getting the 3 pions out of.
So
you would have some operator, which is your signal. And then your noise is going to go as O squared minus
O squared. Yeah, that's
O squared.
Sort of a statistical argument, but I somehow have problems translating, but maybe we can discuss this afterwards, the statistical argument just into what I think of as a path integral.
Right. I mean, the short answer is that you have chi cubed, chi bar cubed on one side, and then it's propagating to some later time where you have chi cubed, chi bar cubed again. So at later time.
So is it a finite?
And so this creates 3 pions?
Yeah, yeah. If you do it like this, yes. But that's okay. Well, we can discuss it afterwards.
Okay, sure. So if you do a vanilla three-point function calculation, this is how you get your matrix elements where you have some current interaction. So you fix your source and sink, typically, and then you would move this current insertion over some range within the center of this. And this is a three-point function. In order to do this, you have to do the two-point function and then try to use what you've computed for these source and sink factors to extract the three-point function. So it's typically pretty difficult. But there are some ways to get around that, and I'll try to talk about some of these. Now, this is a slide which I've stolen from Andreas Kronfeld. He uses this to try to fill out in space where the path forward is. So the simplest thing is to go for the most important and the least difficult. And so this is, of course, the axial form factor for a charge current. Scattering, this is for quasi-elastic scattering. So this is a computation which I've been involved with Richard and Andreas on computing. And I'm not going to talk about my own results, but you can come ask me about those if you want later. But a lot of other people have been computing these recently. So I will try to highlight what they've done. And this is broadly broken up into four categories here. The first is, of course, the axial form factor, which has been the focus of a lot of recent attention. And then I will try to break this up into other things which are very similar to compute. And then you get into some harder things like the transition form factors and two nucleon matrix elements, which are the most difficult. But OK, so I always stress this, and I will try to stress this again, that this is a work in progress, trying to arrange these things on this graph. So if you have input for something which is more important or less important than what's represented here, then I'd like to hear about it. And I will probably ask to bring it up in the discussion section later, or if there's anything that needs to be added as well. But OK, so this is the end of the introduction. I will now go on to the charge current axial form factor. The idea is you have some quasi-elastic scattering. This happens within a nucleus. And the nucleus is some very complicated thing. And we are trying to evaluate how much the nuclear corrections affect this. And one way to do that is to factor it into the nuclear and the nucleus parts and to try to extract the nucleus part as well as possible, and then go back and figure out what the nuclear corrections are. This has been stated many times before. And so what we want to compute on the lattice is the axial form factor part, which goes as the axial form factor and the pseudoscalar form factor. And then you can project out the pseudoscalar form factor to get just the axial form factor Q squared dependence. So that's what we're aiming for. And I'll go through some of the experimental stuff first. Most analyses assume the dipole form factor, which was developed when my parents were in high school. And so it's just given by this form. It was fine when it was introduced, but it has been used ad nauseum. And it's an ansatz. It's unmotivated in the interesting energy region. And it can be shown that it's inconsistent with QCD. So it's really broken. And you can see this by the axial mass problem, as they call it, where you have very different results for the axial mass based on how you fit it. You either see extremely tiny error bars, which are just because you have data which is over-constraining your fit, or you have that it's being convolved with some sort of nuclear effects, and you're actually fitting to an effective axial mass, which takes into account these nuclear effects. In which case, then why are you trying to extract a free nucleon form factor? You should just do the full nuclear thing. So it's essential to try to replace this with some well-motivated parameterization. And that well-motivated parameterization is the Z expansion. Of course, Gil talked about this yesterday, so I'll try to go through it pretty quickly. But you're just doing a clever conformal mapping, which takes you within the unit circle. So you have a small expansion parameter, and you expand in that. But it even works better than that because you can show that the coefficients in this series are bounded and decreasing. So you get very good convergence. You can represent things approximately as a linear slope. There is a linear curve and then maybe some slight curvature to that. And then if you want to, you can use some rules to regulate the large Q squared behavior to get this kind of Lepage scaling out of it. So we did some fits to this, Richard and I and some other collaborators, using some neutrino quasi-elastic scattering. This has been mentioned a few times today, some by Gabe. So one of the things to note is that actually this gives a similar chi-squared per number of degrees of freedom as the dipole form factor. But also, you can see that the first parameter is the most important, and then the other parameters are not so well constrained. This is the expectation. This is reproduced by our fits. So you could ask, why do we bother doing this if it doesn't do any better than the dipole? Well, the point of this is to understand the error bars on the free nucleon form factor. And so we expect the Z expansion to have more realistic error bars than the dipole form factor. And what we see is actually that the Z expansion has much larger error bars than the dipole form factor. So we're seeing that the dipole is significantly underestimating the errors from the free nucleon form factors.
So how do you estimate the errors then for the dipole?
For the dipole, we have... Yeah, so we fit to it, and then we use delta chi squared equals 1 region around the minimum. And I have just done this for a series of points such that I can get a sufficiently smooth curve.
So what does it tell us then?
Yes.
What's the message?
The message is coming up on the next slide. But the spoiler is that what's going to happen is that the we cannot constrain the free nucleon form factors well. And because we can't constrain these, we actually find that the discrepancies between data and the nuclear models, I'll just go to it. Why don't I do that?
Small is being driven by an incorrect assumption.
Yes, and so if you try to compare this to data, you see that actually when you make this error bar significantly larger due to this because you're now realistically estimating the errors, that becomes the same size relatively as the errors on the data. So if you want to describe the data and try to distinguish whether it's a nuclear form factor correction or a nuclear model correction, then you're not going to be able to do that unless you reduce these free nucleon errors. So this is the quasi-elastic the differential cross section as a function of q squared. And so what we're comparing is the differential cross section on a carbon target. And this is done with Gini, with the Z expansion, and then with the dipole model, assuming the world best dipole form factor, which was on the previous slide. With the dipole form factor with the axial mass from the world best, quote unquote, dipole. And so if we go back to that and look at that, we see that the dipole is significantly smaller than the Z expansion. And even in some of the observables, the error bars are an order of magnitude larger.
If I may say something, that's
sure.
Exactly what I was showing yesterday in terms of other quantities that are better measured, like the magnetic radius, electric radius. Because you're using this one parameter model, you get very small error bars. But you know, the best theory is not the one with the smallest error.
This is probably preaching to the choir to some people. I'm saying that this entire thing, not specifically what you said. okay, so moving on to the lattice results. This was at the lattice conference last year. This slide showed up in one of the plenary talks. And so you can see that they say that, of course, the axial form factor is important to neutrino scattering. And they typically assume a dipole. And much to my dismay, they turned our axial radius into an axial mass and then said, let's fit the dipole with that. OK, so it's a start. And this prompted several different computations. And so these are the four that I'm going to really highlight. There was also another computation which used the axial charge, which is the axial form factor at q squared equals zero, which had a nice algorithmic development, which maybe can be applied to the axial form factor in the future if there's some more theory development. And so this axial charge calculation was using the Feynman-Hellman method, which is essentially saying that you add some term to your action, which is dependent on some current insertion. And it's given some sort of bookkeeping factor. And you can evaluate your correlation functions going from vacuum to vacuum in this modified action. And then you can relate that back to your continuum action without this extra current insertion. And so what you find is that this first term is going to vanish most of the time. And then you can compute this this term much more precisely because it doesn't need to involve two points. It doesn't need to go through the full process of computing all three points. It only does a two-point function.
Why is the lambda in the matrix limits? Is that the source or
the state? So this is saying that you're going to compute the vacuum in the presence of this extra
in the. So what do you mean by most of the time? It should all the time it should vanish.
So if this is a scalar current, then it won't necessarily vanish. Well, if it's the scalar current, then you're ending up with the...
No, from the quantum numbers, yes, but it's, the idea is, well, maybe this to do with renormalization, that the wave function should not, normalization should not depend on lambda, it's one. That's the original formulation of it.
What if it was GG? What if it's GG and you have a 1.6?
Well, it just seems a slightly different formulation here. So,
sorry, you're saying it depends on lambda?
In Feynman-Hellman, the idea is that the state itself, it does, the state depends on lambda, but not the normalization of it. Normalization is one.
So you're objecting to the first term? You're saying it's always zero?
Well, in the Feynman-Hellman formulation, yes, but we can also discuss this offline.
Yeah.
I'm actually quite interested in that.
Okay. I think this is just an analytic derivative, and so you're getting rid of all the lambda dependence, but you can still compute its slope, essentially, at the zero point.
The problems of separating excited states from nucleons are still there, right? Are they getting better?
I think we'll come back to this. But in this process, it will still be there. The thing is that you can do it much better statistically. And if you do it much better statistically, then it's easier to try to extract these excited states from your correlation functions. So that's the main idea here. And it's also computationally cheaper, so you can get to higher statistics as well as better variance. Here is a plot of what this looks like if you take this and evaluate it on one ensemble. And so you can see that actually what they've done is they've constructed some matrix element which gives you back the axial charge, the bare axial charge, not the renormalized, if you take this to large times. And so as you go to large times, you see the signal to noise decrease, which is typical of the nucleon matrix elements. But you can see that it's got good statistical properties on the in the center here, and it goes to some plateau value, which you expect to be the axial charge. Now, in practice, you should actually fit this to some functional form and extract the excited states and try to remove them. But this is just a nice consistency check to show that it is working. So this is a nice improvement, and we hope that it can be applied to the axial form factor itself. But so coming back to the excited state contaminations, this is using the typical three-point function method. So what you do is you have some source sink separation, which you're fixing. In this case, this is the different symbols here. So we have 16 time slices, 20, 22, 24. And we're increasing the time separation between those. And along the horizontal axis here, what we're doing is we're moving the current insertion along in between these two current insertion source sink separation times. And on the vertical axis, what we have is we have some ratio, which is constructed again to reproduce the axial form factor. And so this first column is for one unit of lattice momentum. Now this is changing from the first row to the second row to the third row because we're changing the pion mass here. So the form factor is not the same at each of these points, but it should be relatively similar. In the absence of pion mass corrections, it would be the same. The first column here is for one unit of lattice momentum. The second column is for 5 units of lattice momentum. And so what we're actually seeing here is that if there was no excited state contamination, then these plots should all lie on top of each other, and they should all lie on the line here, which is the fit. But we're not seeing that. What we're actually seeing is that when you fit to these things, you get some answer which is much below them. So this is saying that there are excited states in your fits, and you're trying to remove them. And when you remove them, you get some value which is much lower than what you actually see in the data. And so this is just a statement that the excited states are there and you need to fit them away. Now, this excited state contamination For this one, you can see that they've done several fits, and they've tried to use several different methods for extracting them. One which just irritates me to no end is that they do a plateau fit, which is you just fit it to a straight line, which is going across with no slope whatsoever, and you try to fit that. And so people did this for a long time, and then they realized, oh, if you do some sort of two-state fit, then you get some answer which doesn't agree with that. And so people are starting to switch to this two-state fit to try to get rid of these things. And then there's also a summation method, which is the one shown, I guess, in red here, which is trying to fit to the slope as well as the intercept of these data here. And so this is some way to try to take into account these corrections, but it seems like more of a denial that they need to deal with these excited state corrections. So on the right here, what we have is another plot, which is increasing the source sink separation time. And looking at just one current insertion time. And so this is the same kind of plot here on the right. So what they're doing is they're again looking at very large source sink separation times and trying to figure out whether the excited states are there. And so they're arguing that the excited states are gone as soon as this thing touches the two-state fit value. But I could beg to differ about that. Anyway, I will continue on. Now, some of these things are dealing with very large finite volume corrections and chiral extrapolation corrections. So this is a chiral extrapolation. What they have is they have some non-physical pion masses, and they're trying to extrapolate down to the chiral point where you have physical pion masses. And so the form takes something like this, where you have a bare GA given by this GA dot, and your normalized GA is, or your chiral mass corrected GA is this one here. This epsilon is some ratio of your pion mass over your pion decay constant. And what you see here is that this has a negative term here with the log of the pion mass squared dependence. And if you fit to that, you end up seeing something which curves down like this. And so this is what's been plaguing the axial form factor extractions for a long time. And so what they constantly find is that their values are always dipping down to unphysically low values when they do this extrapolation. And so this specific simulation here, they do this extrapolation. They find that it goes way low. And then they say, OK, we're not going to do that. We're just going to fit it to a straight line. And this is our value. So you have to watch out for collaborations doing this type of thing. Not that they can really do any better than this, given what they have. What you really need is just more statistics in here, more ensemble measurements. But those are very expensive and not easy to do. So if you look at the full form factor dependence, what is a common theme is that actually the data from the lattice simulations are much higher than the experimental extrapolation. So in this upper curve, you have an axial mass of 1 and a dipole form factor parameterization, I think. And same thing over here. This is also showing experimental data from a pion electroproduction.
And if you go to the vector channel, is it also overshooting?
No, it's not, actually. So the vector channel is not. The pseudoscalar is, again, I'll show that when I get to it. But so it's hard to say what's going on, because some of these plots actually look like there are or they're actually removing the excited state contaminations. But then when you look at these plots, you come back to that and try to revisit it and figure out exactly what's causing these things. And it's very difficult to try to disentangle these effects. So
the Q is going to go zero limit that you're talking about with experiment, right? You should not worry about the agreement or disagreement of the black line on the upper left, except for Q is going to go zero.
Right.
Right. As far as yes. Maxine's question, you shouldn't worry about the black line except at Q is going to go zero, because this is the first part of Aaron's talk with the underestimated errors. Data.
Yes, and so
Lattice should not try to follow incorrect previous results.
Right. This is also true. So perhaps it's better just to compare it to the data itself, which is in this upper right plot, where the data up here in the gray are the electroproduction data, which if you don't believe the dipole parameterization, you can still try to compare to that data. And we're overshooting that data as well.
Or they should put your form factor on these plots.
This is the dipole bastardization of my our result.
So I'm a bit confused about the data plot. The data points seem to be all over the place.
Yes. I think these are multiple experiments, which are all plotted using the same symbols. So some of these are much higher than the other ones. And I think these all belong to the same experiment, but not to the other ones. It was kind of hard for me to understand that as well.
You said this was pine electroproduction data?
Pine electroproduction data.
So that's like stuff.
Yeah. I can look up the reference if you need.
It was like 70s, I think. We looked at
I think so.
Two, it was like 70s.
Okay. So moving on, here is a summary of the results. One thing to note is that a lot of these collaborations actually did use the Z expansion fit. And then they reported an axial radius, which is fine. But then when they plotted it, they always plotted it using the dipole parameterization. So this is the one collaboration which actually plotted the Z expansion. And so I wanted to show that just for completion.
So the value you got for RA squared minus was
0.46 with an error bar of 0.22 in Fermi squared. So these are quite a bit smaller than that sometimes, within a few sigma smaller. So this is just a reflection that the lattice data are much higher than the experimental data, because a higher axial radius means that it's going to fall off faster. Okay, so moving on. Now I start getting into the more recent calculations, some things which are a bit more technically difficult. So the pseudoscalar form factor is pretty much the same as the axial form factor. The only thing you're doing is replacing the axial current with the pseudoscalar current. And there's one complication in that you can't compute this at q squared equals zero because the spinner factor vanishes. But everything else is exactly the same. And you can actually relate this to the axial form factor through the pion pole dominance, which is just saying that at near q squared equals zero, you can evaluate this pseudoscalar form factor as the axial form factor times some pole term. And this is just related to the partially conserved axial current relation, which is saying that in the limit of vanishing quark mass, you would end up with the axial current being conserved. So one thing which is interesting to note with the lattice data is that they are disagreeing with this relation. And they're disagreeing in the part where it should be actually the most valid. So in the region where q squared goes to zero, it's actually where the lattice data are underestimating the form factor. And so this is a bit strange. The PNDME collaboration, which is the one shown on the right here, they tried to do an analysis to check whether this was actually lattice artifacts which was causing this. Essentially, the fact that you are not simulating at the physical point, but at some discrete lattice spacing. And they ended up coming up saying that it doesn't look like it's discretization effects, but that their analysis was inconclusive. So it's a bit interesting to note this. Another thing which you can see on the right here is that one of these collaborations, the ETMC collaboration, did an extraction where they fit both using the pion pole dominance ansatz and without it. And so if you use the pion pole dominance ansatz, you get agreement with the experiment, the few experiment results from muon capture experiment. And if you don't use that pion pole dominance, then you disagree in the same way that the PNDME collaboration is seeing. So this is a a strange result.
Our experimental tests exclude that. In fact, I'm trying to, at some point I wrote a paper that claimed that there can't be a violation that's that large. So I'm trying desperately to remember what the argument was.
Right. I don't know that argument.
So I'll try to dig that up. I thought there were direct experimental tests of this that essentially rule out a deviation.
Yes. So one thing this could be, again, is the excited state contaminations. So they do everything they can to claim that there's no excited state contaminations in the axial form factor data, but then they say that it may be the cause of this. So I find that to be highly dubious, but we can argue about that later. But okay, so this is an interesting result. The next thing that we can focus on is the disconnected diagram. So whereas before we were only focusing on charge current interactions, where actually this current insertion was connected directly to the nucleon operator. Now we have some disconnected loop, which is interacting with the current. And then this is connected to the three valence quarks by just gauge fields. So you can imagine connecting it with any number of gauge fields, gluon fields between those two points. And so this is much harder to compute for technical reasons. The technical reasons are that it depends very heavily on the gluons going between these. And because of the way you're constructing the observable, you are summing over many gauge configurations. And those gauge, let me say that again. We're computing it on a gauge configuration, which is just some specification of the background gauge field. And then you would sum that over many gauge fields to try to take into account the gauge effects. Now this is highly dependent on what your gauge fields look like, this type of measurement. And if you don't simulate with a lot of gauge fields, then you have a hard time trying to extract the realistic physics which is going on in here. So you need to have lots of gauge configurations to do this well. And if you try to use stochastic methods to approximate this better, you end up saturating your stochastic methods much faster than in other types of computation. So it's very difficult to do, and it takes a lot of computing time to do well. But a few collaborations have done some methods to try to improve this. One was the LHPC collaboration. They used a method which figured out this quark matrix element could be extracted more efficiently. Essentially, typically what you would do is you would compute the inverse of the Dirac matrix to get the quark propagator, and then you would perform the trace. What they do is they just solve for the trace directly. They don't even bother with the inversion. And then they also combine this with some way to sample the phase space more efficiently. And if you do that, you see that actually this improves quite a bit in terms of computing time for the magnetic form factor. But if you try to apply this to the axial form factor or the axial charge, it doesn't work so well. It still is an improvement, but it's only a factor of 1.4 improvement. So it's not great, but it is an improvement. And so they use this to try to extract the form factor Q squared dependence much better. And it turns out that it does work quite well. They can get the disconnected piece more. I should be careful. These are not at the same level of statistics. But they are getting a very precise result for the disconnected piece. Another collaboration did the same thing. They also see some sort of result like this. They take advantage of some lattice action arguments, which allow them to get better statistical cancellation. So this is a nice result. I think this is a very standard result, though. Okay, so now I get into the part where I'm just showing you some of the computations which have been done. So one thing is transition form factors. Now this is saying you have some nucleon, it goes to a delta, and then the delta decays away. We want to evaluate the form factor going from the nucleon to the delta. And this becomes complicated if you have unstable particles. So for instance, the delta is just a resonance. It's an unstable particle. And if you try to simulate this on the lattice, what you end up with is not the delta itself, but n pi states. And these n pi states are very hard to fit within a box. And what you end up with is very big volume corrections. So this is shown in these two plots here. This is not the nucleon delta. This is kind of just a demonstration showing a 2-pion state versus the rho meson. And so on the left here, what you have is a rho meson, which is in between being stable and being below threshold. And so you end up seeing these very long types of volume dependence, which is just your spectrum is going through a phase shift. So plotted on the horizontal axis here is the pion mass versus the times the lattice box extent. So this is a measure of how efficiently your pions will propagate through the boundary conditions. So it's a statement of how large your box is compared to how far the pions can propagate. And then on the vertical axis, you have the invariant mass of the rho meson center mass frame with respect to pion mass values. And so you can see that this goes through some values there. On the other hand, if you had a stable particle, it would decay away like this, and you'd see a very flat region, which is what you typically end up with. This would be the same for a nucleon state, which you try to fit in a box. If your box is too small, you'll see some slight volume corrections, but for the most part, it should be relatively invariant over those corrections. And so this becomes a very difficult problem to deal with in lattice. The way around it is just to keep m pi large. If you keep m pi large, then your delta is no longer unstable, so you don't have this problem. And so this is what was done, for better or for worse, by the ETMC collaboration. They are the only ones to have done it, and this is the result they get. Now this was actually a decade old, so these are very large pion masses with a pion mass of 560 MeV. And then also no C quarks in their field.
In such a case, sure. Does the extrapolation tell you anything? Because where you eventually go, the physics are so different.
I guess you could debate that. I'm not sure it's been studied thoroughly because this is the only result. So it might be worth studying, but I don't know the answer to your question. The last thing is two nucleon matrix elements. So these are useful for instance, in the neutrinoless double beta decay. So you have some lepton number violating matrix element, and you're trying to compute that. And so there has been some work on this. Specifically, the most interesting one is this one down here, because this is the nucleon matrix element and the hardest to compute. And there are at least two collaborations working on this. It's underway, but it's not complete yet. So there has been some work on the other diagrams. This first one is the most important of the other diagrams, because this one has the this one is not vanishing. I believe there is some arguments for why these two should be vanishing. I am blanking on why that is right now. But if you go and compute those, these are the results you get. And then they're working on trying to do this with two nucleon form factors with short range correlations. And so this specific collaboration has a stupidly large amount of computing time to do this. Stupidly large meaning orders of billions of core hours. I'm quite interested to see how they do. Now, another collaboration which is doing this is focused on some of these large nuclei. So they're actually doing hydrogen with three nucleons, tritium, and then also with deuterium. And so they're trying to evaluate the axial current matrix elements on these, specifically because they're focused on the Gamow-Teller transition, which is shown to be quenched in most nuclear corrections, and for reasons we don't know. And this is important for neutrinoless double beta decay because the beta decay depends on this to the fourth power. So if you are not able to evaluate this efficiently, then you're going to end up messing up your matrix element by up to a factor of two. So this is exciting to see, but I can't really say much more than that. They're also using pion masses up to 800 MeV, so very large pion masses, high enough where you can use pionless effective field theory to compute these things. So OK, just to conclude, Lattice is a good tool for thinking about neutrino physics and to try to evaluate these systematic uncertainties. But of course, more dialogue with experimentalists is needed to try to correct the Lattice theorists who are working on this and doing silly things. But there are advances in computing power which help to extract these matrix elements and allow for more sophisticated analyses. It's an excellent tool. We're improving. And we should be able to compute some of the baryon physics needed for neutrino physics. And so thanks for listening.
More questions?
This is sort of a, not exactly a physics question, but you talk about advances in computing power, so there has been this big explosion in GPU computing recently. Has that meaningfully changed the landscape for Lattice QCD?
So this helps with the overhead costs, actually. And so the algorithms are not quite in place for all the collaborations, but they're definitely working on it, and they're trying to take as much advantage of this as possible. One of the collaborations is using this heavily, and they're getting factors of 10 or 100 improvement in their statistics by using GPUs specifically.
So I thought it was GPUs were already like sort of de facto, but they aren't. It's they're being adopted?
They're being adopted.
Okay.
Yes. You have to make sure your algorithms work when you move them to these other.
Of course.
And then
yeah,
there's some optimizations which have to be done as
well. I just assumed that it had already been done, but okay, so it's not. Okay.
Nope, not quite.
And then, so is it? But is this meaningfully changing the landscape? I mean, are there questions that people are saying that previously people, a year or two or three or four or whatever ago, said, it's too computationally intensive, but then sort of now they're starting to change to say this is worth going after, et cetera?
I think so, but I think it's a more drawn out process than that. These computations take a long time to complete, so. When you say you want to start a calculation, this is thinking 2 years ahead when you're actually going to start computing things.
So you were involved, or you're involved in both, you know, extracting the XL form factor from data and from Lattice.
Right.
And can you comment? Maybe you can go back to the experimental extraction and mm-hmm. kind of connect it with Richard was mentioning repeating those experiments or. I just want the deuterium,
The previous.
I think the previous slide was better. No.
Previous slide?
I don't know.
This is the data you're looking at?
Yeah. I don't know which one. So is the lattice going to be kind of do better on these coefficients in terms of the uncertainty, let's say? Speculatively, I guess.
Speculatively.
You can even take like a certain whatever 5-year time frame.
I think that it will do better. And so my comparison is this plot here. So this plot has precise data out to 1.2 GeV squared. So if we can use that to try to extract the axial form factor, then I think that can do pretty precisely.
So
the experiment would not just be a quasi-elastic piece, it's all of the rest of the stuff that would also be of interest. And looking at hydrogen and deuterium and nuclear effects, and one of the problems with the experiment is that the deuterium effects were thought to be small and negligible. They appear to be not small and negligible. And if we want to understand nuclear interactions on carbon, oxygen, or argon, we should better understand them first on neutrons. So there are a lot of things with an experiment like that would be complementary to the lattice. And I think Aaron gives a very safe
this comment just to make is, you know, I mean, of course, at some point, you know, just using one number, MA, RA, whatever, is silly.
Right.
Because what you're interested in is actually this. That's what
right.
the genome experiment is doing, right? So if we're trying to compare data based on RA, that's kind of...
Well, if you really want to use a one-parameter model, then you use the Z expansion with A1.
No, I understand, but I'm saying at some point you want to see whether, you know, whatever, the extraction. So what you want to feed to the trainer experiment is a table of numbers that they can use with some error bars, right? So that's,
right.
it's not the RA or the MA or any of these things.
Right.
But if you successfully have done that, at least in my experience of how we've translated everything that you guys have done to what we're trying to do on TDK, like we've been able to pick up nice little covariance with your nice little parameters, so the system works.
I was not involved in this analysis, just to clarify. So
yeah. I was just clarifying that I think he's successfully done this.
Yes, so we provide an axial radius because it's an easy number to
right,
quote.
Right, no, I
but if we do an extraction, we should be extracting the full the Z expansion parameters and the covariance matrix relating to Z expansion parameters and hand those off to the experimentalists. And then
precision is not precision in one parameter.
Right.
I would echo Gil's comments, but I would also say that if you can find any one parameter that is physically well-defined and which different experiments can compare, you should do that. And Kendall will, I think, agree that there is an absence of such parameters that we can find and compare, and the comparison is often very difficult. So if Lattice can compare with experiment on this one parameter, that's a very useful tool. And of course, as you say, it's not the only thing. And you can also look at other places. For example, muon capture will only give you RA, but that in itself is already a very important constraint if you combine it with the material data or the games that you're playing.
Okay, let's wrap up the session there. And thank you, everyone.